Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
Hey, this is Hannah, HRN's program manager. It's HRN's 10th anniversary and now our summer fun drive. So show your support for independent, revolutionary, entertaining food radio by becoming a monthly recurring donor. HRN is powered by a passionate community of thoughtful eaters, and we need each and every one of you to show your support so that we can keep bringing you your favorite food podcasts. It takes a village, and every dollar donated, every listener tuning in is essential to our continued success. So set up a donation for $10 every month. You'll show us that you want to be a part of a bright future for HRN. And you'll get one of our brand new limited edition Pizza Pocket t-shirts. So snag your new favorite tea and show us some love, all for the price of about two fancy lattes each month. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate today, and thank you.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi, ramen, izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, so I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. My guest today is Gaston Bechelano, who is the co-founder and CEO of Bonsai Kakigori, which opened in April this year. And kakigori is a traditional Japanese icy dessert. It is similar to snow cones, but is distinctly different. And it's a very nostalgic, culturally important food for the Japanese. So today we'll discuss how Gaston got into the world of kakigori, why it is a great tool to understand the sense of Japanese culture, and why what unique items are on the menu at the Bonsai Kakigori, and much, much more. But quickly, before we start, Japanese is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japanese. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have any ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or kikokatema.com. Now let's start a conversation with Gaston Bechelano. Hello, Gaston. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, it's such a kakigori day.
Yeah, it's warm in New York.
So, I wish you had some bowl of kakigori, but I'll save for later today, maybe.
Yeah.
And so, first of all, where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
I was born in Mexico City. I lived there until I was 8 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
Surprise. Interesting.
So, growing up, I was able to eat very delicious Mexican food. When I was eating outside the home, I was able to eat what you would imagine Mexican food being. So tacos, enchiladas for breakfast, chilaquiles, and a variety of really, really delicious Mexican dishes.
Mm.
At home, it was also very, very delicious. Lots of rice-centric dishes with a lot of spices and a lot of Mexican candy, which happens to be very spicy.
Wait. Wow, that's interesting. It's a shocking surprise. And then you grew up in after eight. Where did you...
So after I grew, I moved to Miami.
Okay.
With my family. And Miami was a little bit of an extension of Latin America. So many different Latin cultures moved to Miami. So then Mexico sort of became like Venezuela, Argentina, Colombia, Ecuador, Uruguay, and started mixing a little bit of food from all those different cultures.
Right. Interesting.
And Cuban also.
Yeah, then usually I ask this question to trace something back between like Japanese and non-Japanese thing. It's like very interesting. Yeah, but the common thing, Japanese and Mexican, they're both good food countries.
Yeah. Yes, I agree.
So, and you opened the Bonsai Kakigori in Lower East Side, Manhattan, in April 2019. So what kind of work experience did you have before opened the business?
Yeah, so we opened the standalone brick and mortar in April 27th of this year, but we had opened another location, our first market location in Canal Street Market, almost a year and a half now. Before that, so I graduated Tufts in 2017, and then I moved to New York to start a job actually at IBM.
Yeah. That was a surprise.
Doing marketing at IBM. When I graduated to when I started the job, I had a little bit of time, and I spent that time traveling in Japan. Came to New York, started my job at IBM, and then very quickly realized that it shouldn't, wasn't for me a little bit. And then a couple of months later, we opened the first little.
So we'll discuss the calling in a moment. First of all, I think most of listeners don't know what kakigori is. So what is kakigori?
So kakigori is a Japanese style of shaved ice. For a lot of people in the United States, they might immediately associate it with, something else that they've had growing up that has ice in it, like a snow cone. But really, it's hard to describe how different it is. But it's a very delicate sort of fluffy ice as opposed to this granular crunchy ice that you get as a snow cone. And in Japan, it's celebrated as a really important dessert that's been around since the 11th century, Heian period in Japan, that's paired with these beautiful seasonal syrups made from fresh fruit.
Interesting.
Because
I think Japanese summer is very humid and hot, so even from 11th century, people wanted to cool it down by eating ice. It's interesting that, snow cone, you can walk around as you eat snow cone, but kakigori, you can't, right? You have to sit down because it's a huge pile of snowy, delicate ice.
So, yeah, it's nice to be able to sit down and enjoy it.
Right.
It would be very difficult to transport this big mountain. but there's also something really nice about just sitting down and being able to enjoy something without being on the go.
Right. So it's an ice. How do you... Right. So what's more like detailed description? Like, say, you go to the shop, kakigori shop in Japan. What happens? Like, what's served on the table?
So my favorite, I guess I can describe my favorite shop in Japan. It's called Pass the Baton in Kyoto, in Gijon. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Gion.
It's this beautiful building right alongside this really gorgeous river. You walk in to the left-hand side. There's this like retail section with very curated clothing, and then to the right-hand side is a cafe. You sit down. There's a limited menu of like 4 to 5 flavors that change very, very often. Then you order it, and then they bring to you this enormous like mountain of kakigori, shaved ice, on this beautiful, beautiful ceramic bowl. Some of them might have little toppings on the side. Some of them might have a little sauce that you can pour on top of it. But really what steals the show is this like enormous head-shaped bowl of ice with different colors and different toppings that is quite intimidating when you first see it.
Right. Yeah, but surprisingly, nobody gets, you don't need to run to the bathroom after that because it's so fluffy and the delicate ice that it's more like air piled up with ice.
Yeah, it's so fluffy. Right. So many people at Bonsai see somebody get a large and they immediately... like their eyes become like 3 times the size. So like, what is that? like mountain. But then I very calmly tell them that it's mostly very fluffy ice. That's it's not so filling.
So the difference between snow cone and is that it's served in a beautiful bowl vessels, and it's sizable but delicate, and it's topped with certain toppings and syrup. So what's the classic flavors of kakigori?
So the ones I experienced when I was in Japan were like just like in Japanese culture, in Japanese cooking culture, like very seasonal fresh fruit. So for example, when I first visited Japan and was enjoying the kakigori, I would be in Tokyo, and like melon was like extremely prevalent in that region, for example. And then I would go a little bit south of that and go to Osaka and Kobe and Kyoto, and like peaches were more prevalent there. So just focusing on like very seasonal fruit, those are the classic flavors, so like melon, peach, summer fruits, right. Strawberry, cherry.
So that is the idea of kakigori. And when I grew up, like, you know, neighborhood, there's a nothing place. There's a flag, shows ice and the blue and red color. You don't miss it. But I grew up a really cheap version. The ice is fluffy and nice, but there's some chemical colored syrup, which was good for kids because it's just sweet and cold. But yeah, I think it's so much better versions, and that's what you are doing here in New York.
Thank you. Yeah. It's delightful.
So, okay. And so how do you make the ice so fluffy?
So the reason why the ice gets to be so fluffy in the first place is that the block itself is made from just water. So other variations of the dessert, like bingzu, for example, you shave ice, but the block is infused with milk. So that when you shave it, the shavings tend to be more like shaved ice cream. So when you take a bite, it melts in your mouth like ice cream. So the first thing is having a block that is just water.
Right.
So it shaves it really, really finely. And then the second part of the equation is just having the right machine. There are certain machines that will shave an ice block very granularly that will mimic a snow cone. And there's certain machines that will shave it, you know, extremely fluffily. I don't know if that's even a word, but very fluffy ice.
Right.
And then it's just understanding how to use the machine.
It's like an espresso machine, sounds like.
Yeah. So that's funny. We tell it to our staff all the time, is making a kakigori is almost like an art. It is an art, just like the art of espresso.
Right. Yeah. So I, you know, like when I grew up, there's like a hand cranking machine, which is fun, and you try it as a toy, which is good. As a result, you can make kakigori by yourself. But I think it's really high-tech, and I engineer it now. So the machine kind of controls the pressure or the air, amount of air or shape of the ice. Is that what it does?
So the machine controls really two variables. It controls the pressure of the ice going downwards, so it compresses this ice 6x6 ice block, pushing it downwards.
Right.
And then the other variable that it controls is the angle of the blade and how sharp the blade is. So if you're pushing the ice block, you know, harder down, if you think about, you know, squeezing like a fruit, right?
Right.
Really, really strongly. You're gonna squeeze more juice out of it.
Right.
And then if you start, you know, cutting that fruit, it's gonna get cut really, really easily and very hard. And the second variable, the blade, is extremely important. So if you have a very dull blade in maybe a machine that's not necessarily the best, it's not gonna cut that ice in a very fluffy manner.
Right.
So those two variables need to be playing in the right way so that the equation gives you really nice fluffy ice.
Right. Sounds like a Japanese knife and with an espresso machine combined in one machine. Yeah, but are they expensive to buy?
You know, relatively no. A machine can run you like maybe like $2,000, whereas an espresso machine is far more expensive than
that. Like I've seen at like $15,000 or something for Mazako kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are quite pricey.
Right. Yeah, but I've seen a few Google, Amazon, Japan, they have home electric kagiori machine too. So you can actually buy it for your home.
That's what I did initially when I came back to New York. And I missed kakigori so much. I ordered a machine to my apartment, much to the anger and dismay of my roommate, because the machine took up like half the kitchen. Because the New York kitchens are so small.
Right.
So like, you know, back then, my roommate Max was like, "Hey Max, you know, I'm getting this machine from Japan. Is that okay with you?" I straight up shot him a text. He's like, "Yeah, no worries. That's totally fine." Him probably thinking that it was like this small machine. And then like come like the next 2 weeks, he like walks into the apartment after work. I'm like playing with the kakigori machine. And he sees this monstrous blue machine taking up like half the counter. He's like, "Is that the machine that you told me you're going to?" Like, "Yes. Don't worry though. I'll make you kakigori."
Yeah.
And he was kind enough not to be too angry.
Right. Well, he must be really happy today with something. So that's the kind of, I don't know, and I've seen kakigori in New York City at several restaurants, not the, you know, specialized shops or anything, but I started to see kakigori in several Japanese restaurants or the cafes. So what do you think about that? Do you think people love it?
I hope so. I love seeing other people do kakigori. I'm a big believer in a rising tide lifting all boats. So I know the Intersect by Lexus in Meatpacking just released their summer kakigori. It's both alcoholic and non-alcoholic.
Interesting. Wait a minute. Oh, so by the way, just the Lexus, what's the name again? The place.
The Intersect?
Yeah. So that's by Union Square Hospitality Group.
Yeah.
Like the theme changes, chef changes. It's kind of like interesting themed restaurant. So sounds like that trendy place features a kakigori. That's a very interesting thing.
I mean, it's wonderful when a company like Union Square Hospitality Group chooses to release this pop-up of kakigori. It really validates the dessert.
Right.
So that's great for us and great for the concept of
maybe
the dessert.
You inspired them.
I hope so.
Yeah. Well, I keep hearing, since you opened, I keep hearing more about kakigori. So you definitely did something right for the world of kakigori. But you said the alcohol infused like a sauce on top.
So they're doing two versions. They're doing an alcoholic version of the kakigori. They're doing, I think, two flavors. And then they're also featuring those flavors, I believe, without alcohol.
Interesting. That reminds me of Mexican margarita.
Yeah, that would be a great flavor.
Right?
Maybe a future flavor. We're trying to get our liquor license at Bonsai in the Lower East Side. So hopefully in the fall we can offer the margarita kakigori.
I've never seen any kakigori with alcohol sauce, alcoholic sauce on top. So that's really a good idea, right?
Thank you.
Yeah, I think.
I'm sure the crowd on the Lower East Side will enjoy.
Right. Well, that's the thing about whatever comes to America, hit the land, that the old concepts become something more interesting and exciting. So, yeah, I really appreciate that, this culture.
Yeah, I think we're excited to offer different flavors, but also make sure that we're respecting the dessert and where it comes from at the same time.
Okay. Let's take a quick break here, and then when we come back, I want to discover how you discover that classic style of kakigori. So please stay with us. Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they are located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit corin.com. Welcome back. You are listening to Japanese Broadcasting Live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Aki Katayama, and my guest today is Gaston Bechelano, who is the co-founder and CEO at Bonsai Kakigori, which opened in April this year. So now let's talk about your journey with Kakigori. So how did you get into Kakigori? You went to Japan, and I want to know from why did you go to Japan in the first place?
So I had a period of time before I was going to come to New York. My job started in October, and I graduated in May. Mm. And I decided to do a little bit of traveling. And I think, you know, there's maybe two different versions, which is go to a lot of places and spend a little bit of time in each place and get to see a bunch of places, or go to one place, spend a lot of time in one place, and really get to see that place.
Mm.
And I always was intrigued by Japanese culture. I took a couple of classes about Japanese economy and Japanese culture in college that sparked my interest. There was a little flame. And so I decided to opt for that second option of travel and spend a large part of that time in Japan before I came to New York.
Right. So, and how did you stumble on Kakigori?
Yeah, I mean, I was traveling in Japan when it was really hot in the summer and just was walking. So the first time I had Kakigori was 8 days into my trip. I was in Kanazawa in the, I hope I don't mispronounce it, but the Omicho market, the food market in Kanazawa. And I was walking along and I just like, it was paradise for me. Like it was a food market in Japan. Mm. So I love food and Japanese food is delicious.
Yeah, that's an awesome food market. I went there.
Oh, fantastic food
market.
Yeah,
you can spend hours and hours.
Which is what I did. I spent like an hour and a half eating my way through the market, like just a ton of fish and like, you know, Japanese food and these oysters that they were grilling. And then I was like, you know, had some nuts and some dessert and I was extremely full. And I was going through the market and I was like, you know what would be really nice right now? Like a smoothie or like something really cold would be like fantastic. I was super hot, really full. And then I see this older gentleman sitting down like a couple meters away from me, eating something that looked very icy, which was a kakigori.
Right.
And I looked at him. He looked like he was just absolutely loving what he was eating. Like he was eating it like in slow motion. So I went up to him. I was like, hey, in English, like just, you know, out loud, not cognizant that he probably didn't speak in any English. I was like, hey, man, like, what are you eating? Like, where can I get what you're eating? Mm. And he looks at me very slowly and like says something in Japanese. I don't understand what he's saying.
Mm.
And like, we do a back and forth of him telling me in Japanese what he was eating and me saying like, I'm sorry, I don't understand what you're eating. Please tell me like what you're eating. And then he gets like visibly frustrated, like stands up, grabs me by the arm and then walks me across the market and takes me to the place they're making kakigori.
Awesome.
And then actually ends up paying for it. And I had a mango kakigori.
Wow.
Which was nice. I like experienced Japanese hospitality and kakigori at the same time.
Holy, yeah.
So it was a nice first experience.
I hear it. That happens often in Japan, right? People just decide to just, all right, let me just do it. Whatever I can do for you.
Yeah.
But that's crazy. Nice. So that was, so how was that? It was a classic style kakigori?
Yeah, it was comparatively to the one, to other ones I've had, it was pretty bad, to be honest. It was a mango kakigori, which like just hit the spot at that moment because it was super hot and I was full. But yeah, it was, you know, regular kakigori with, it was kind of granular, just had one syrup that sort of tastes artificial, but very sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was my first experience. And then slowly from there, I started to realize that it was such a like, staple dessert in the summer and started seeking it out at like other cafes and started to sort of learn that there were cafes all around Japan that were doing it at a very, very high level.
Mm. So you traveled around Japan, right? And how many days did you spend?
So I was in Japan for like 2.5 months.
Oh, okay. Wow.
That summer. Three months.
So. How many kakigori did you eat?
Oh my God. Like more than 100.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Wow. So you can probably like make a ranking of what's the best. Like your favorite was the Kyoto one you spoke earlier, right?
So my favorite one was Kyoto, but that was, I only had that one the second time I visited Japan last summer.
Okay.
That first trip, my favorite one was in Yanaka in Tokyo. So at a place called Himitsudo. That was my favorite one.
Yeah. So what's special about their kakigori?
So it was like 3 days before I was going to leave Japan, and somebody had told me about this place in Yanaka. So I show up. They're like, you should show up early. Like, there's going to be a big line. So I go at like 8:30 in the morning. I like hoping to, I'm feeling good about myself. Like, I'm going to beat the crowd. Like, this is going to be great. I show up and there's like a 3 hour line already.
Wow.
Like, huge amount of people lined up because it's like, you know, dead of summer. It's so hot. And I'm like, well, I'm leaving in 3 days. Like, I might as well line up for this place that people tell me so good. And I line up, and I had a, they only allow you to have one kaikigori because there's such a wait. And the place itself is just, you know, super rustic. They're using like hand crank machines. Like, you walk in and there's like a line of like 6 or 7 machines cranking at once because there's such a demand for kaikigori.
Right.
And the flavor that I had was a melon kaikigori. And what was so delicious about it was they, first of all, the ice is like extremely, extremely fluffy. Mm. Like, so, so light.
Do you think because it's a hand cranked? Or
yeah, I think that's one of the variables. They actually use, they harvest the ice that they use from a lake in Hokkaido.
Oh, wow.
And then bring it to Tokyo, and they like store it in their freezers.
Wow.
So they use like really natural, extremely clear ice blocks. And the kaikigori that I had was the melon kaikigori, but it was sprayed with this like a condensed milk concoction of some sorts. So the outer layer had like sweetened condensed milk, and then you poured the melon syrup, and it was just unbelievable.
By the way, the condensed milk is really one of the classic, you know, the juice, like the sauce, historically, traditionally. So it makes sense that they use the spray. But you don't use spray traditionally, so it'd be a kind of like highly engineered version of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But ice is really, right? That's really the main taste that you have. Mm-hmm. So ice is good. It's like whatever that works.
Yeah, it's a perfect vehicle for flavor. So it's like a blank canvas that absorbs these flavors so, so well. And so if you do these flavors well, they sort of just punch you in the face.
Right.
If, you know, if it's really fresh fruit, you get a big punch of of grapes, of melon, of peach right in the face, because it's such a good vehicle for flavor.
I'm curious though, the kind of melon, was that a watermelon or just a...
It was a green.
Green melon. Yeah. Green melon is very popular in Japan as a very high priced item too.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Hopefully it wasn't too expensive.
It was really expensive. Yeah. It's like $20 for this guy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Worth, I think it's worth it. Some people.
Yeah, because they have to ship the ice from Hokkaido, which is already, you have to pay for airfare. So, okay. And so I will try to go there next time. Hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully you don't have to wait 3 hours in line.
Yeah.
But it's worth
maybe
it.
Maybe I'll try like October or sometime later. Okay. And so why did you decide to open a kaikigori shop? That's like a big leap.
So I didn't necessarily like really fall in love with kaikigori itself. I, you know, so when I was traveling in Japan those 3 months, I would visit these kisaten, and just like, you know, like many other things about Japan, I fell in love with how I felt in the kisaten.
So maybe you can define quickly what a kisaten is.
Sure. So it's a Japanese like coffee tea house. And they serve a variety of different food. They serve tea, they serve coffee, they serve like small dishes.
Right.
And some of them might serve desserts. So there's kisaten that end up serving kaikigori.
Right. And they are usually kind of nostalgic and very obsessive with the quality of what they serve. The kisaten.
So one of the things I, you know, generally, I just fell in love with how I felt. And I started to get frustrated because I would go to all these kisatens and I'd always feel amazing. So it got to the point where I was like, why am I feeling so good? Like, what is going on here? Like, why do I end up like smiling every time I go to these places? And it really was, you know, if you break down the experience of a restaurant, it's the customer service, the hospitality, the food, and the ambiance. And those are, for me, the four key tenets, right? And they were doing those extremely well. Like, it was really nostalgic. The ambience was super cozy and very welcoming. Their hospitality, the omotenashi, was just so nice for me. Like, I clicked with it right away. The customer service was fantastic.
Right.
And so of that's course, the food product was great.
But the word omotenashi, we keep hearing it, but I think by definition, it's a service, but they don't expect any return by serving you. So that's kind of, even it's cool not to be unnoticed even. That's the mindset. So, yeah.
Yeah, but it just feels very from the heart.
Right.
It just feels like they're doing it because making you happy makes them happy.
Right.
It's not a transactional feeling.
Mm. That's like the guy who took you to the first kakigori place. Yeah. Omotenashi.
Yep.
Right. Okay. So where are we? So the kisaten. And then, so you decided to open kakigori place, but not for the sake of opening kakigori place. You just wanted to reproduce the omotenashi?
Yeah, so I always wanted to get into restaurants. I always loved the fact that you walk into a place, they do a little bit of magic to you, and you walk out feeling better. Like, I just love the psychology of restaurants and everything that goes into it. When I came back to New York, I was very excited to find a kisaten because New York has everything in the world.
Mm.
And I didn't sort of quite find that same place that I, you know, experienced so vividly in Japan. So it was a sort of a combination of really missing the dessert and wanting to get into restaurants and wanting to recreate that place both for myself but also for people to experience.
Right. So, by the way, well, we're going to discuss deeper about the concept of your place, but you have a business partner, Theo Friedman. So who is he and how did he join you to start the business?
Yeah, so Theo went to Tufts with me.
Mm.
He's 2 years older. And when I came back to New York, I started reaching out to people that worked in the restaurant industry. So Theo is a extremely, extremely talented chef who worked at really high-end restaurants, WD-50, one of them, and then started his own catering company, Theory Kitchen, in New York. So I started talking to him, and we met, and he's like, yeah, like, what are your, you know, what do you want to do? He asked me, like, what do you want to do with restaurants? And he's like, and I said, well, short term, I'm thinking about like this kakigori idea. Long term, I want to open a restaurant. And he's like, what's kakigori? And then I started telling him about what it was, showing some pictures. And I said, like, you know, I actually have one, you know, machine in my house. Like, you should like come and like try it. That was the first time we met. I didn't know him at Tufts.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We like got coffee, and that was the first time we met. And I was like, hey, you should come over and like, I'll make you this dessert in my apartment. He's like, he probably thought I was crazy. And then a couple of days later, he came and he brought some sauces. I made the dessert and we like combined it. And that's how we started talking about starting something with kakigori.
Right. Huh. So he's a WD-50 grad. That means he's very scientifically, you know, advanced and analytical in approaching food. So he may be upgrading some sort of classic version of kakigori sauces. Right. So that's a good partner.
Yeah, no, he's great. I don't know how to cook. So all the flavors that we have that I think are all of them are absolutely delicious. You know, all of them we can attribute to Theo. Like, very, very talented and just very thoughtful about how he develops flavors. But also, you know, generally he had experience in restaurants. I didn't coming into New York. So a lot of what I learned about how to, you know, open something with restaurants, I learned because of him.
Right.
So like, you know, all the way from like how to organize your inventory to how to, like, as funny as it sounds, like sweep the floors properly. He was able to sort of show me a little bit of how to do that.
Right.
So it's not just the flavors that he contributes to bonsai. There's, you know, a lot more that he does that make bonsai what it is right now.
Yeah. I was wondering though, because your menu items are very well kind of written up, and I was curious. So that's Theo. So let's talk about what's on the menu. So what kind of kakigori do you have on the menu?
Yeah, so we split our menu up in two ways, classics and seasonal. So the classics stay on the menu, and then the seasonals fluctuate with the seasons. On the classics, we have the strawberries and cream, the coconut lime crunch, matcha mountain, this delicious flavor espresso peanut that is really salty and, you know, has these really strong notes of espresso. And my favorite from that menu, the banana miso maple, which is delicious. Has some good umami, really, really salty, which I like. And has this delicious banana milk. And then the seasonals, the summer seasonals, which just came out last Tuesday. Those are top notch. I think those are his best batch yet. We have an Arnold Palmer, which is my favorite. A raspberry rose, blueberry cheesecake, caramel corn, and lychee watermelon.
Oh my god!
And the Arnold Palmer and the caramel corn are, yeah, they're good.
Yeah.
When I want to have them like for a week straight, you know, and I have unlimited access, so like, you would think that it would die down in demand for yourself. They don't. Like, I don't have them right
now. Wow. Hopefully you're gonna keep it on the menu for a long time. Yeah, I'll try to get there soon to taste it. But for instance, you know, that is that the one item? You have four ingredients, right? You just said Arnold Palmer, blueberry, and I mean the caramel corn, and it's, how does it look like?
Yeah, so it's 10 different flavors, five classics, five seasonals.
Oh, okay, right.
So the Arnold Palmer itself is one flavor.
Oh, right, one flavor. Okay.
So it's for that one, for example, is half lemonade, half black tea, poached peaches, whipped cream, and then a peach ginger jam.
Right. Oh, the ginger, that would be great.
Yeah.
Nice. I was curious, is the coconut lime crunch? So what's the crunch part?
So the crunch part is toasted coconut. It's coconut flakes with some agave and salt. We bake them, and there's some really nice texture.
So how do you come up with these items? Like, you discuss it in a certain theme, like it reminds me of the season or childhood memories or anything like that?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of both, to be honest. You just nailed it right there. It's what, first of all, I think the way we approach flavors, and I'm sort of speaking for Theo here, but it's just trying to make something that's delicious. Like, you want to take a bite out of a kakigori and just close your eyes and say, oh my God, that's really good. So that's the first sort of goal that you want to hit. It's like, is this delicious? And then when we think about flavors, it's, is that going to be one of the best menu items that we have up there? Like, does this deserve to be up there as opposed to this other menu item?
Right.
And then the third one that I like to think about is that menu item going to be the best menu item, period? Like, if there were 400 kakigori shops in the United States, is that menu item going to beat all the other 400 menu shops? And then, you know, once though we think about those parameters, then it's like, okay, what do we find delicious and what is seasonal? So like peaches right now are awesome. You know, I haven't asked him, but I'm sure Theo likes Arnold Palmer's. And then he brings it to me and says, like, what do you think about this? And I have the best job when it comes to flavors. He just like makes everything. Then I get to taste test it and say, like, yeah, I think we should add this and I think we should add that. And so for the Arnold Palmer, I tasted it and I was like, you know what would be great in this flavor? Some poached peaches, like right in the middle. It's like you start digging at the top, and then once you start getting a little bit, you know, tired of the black tea and the lemonade, you dig in and you find the poached peaches.
Right.
So that's...
It's a, to me, it's, how inspiring is it that Theo doesn't know the original kakigori in Japan? So he has a very fresh view to it, and he's elevating the flavor experience. So that's such a great thing happening.
I agree. I think it's nice when you're not tied down by previous experiences or expectations, and you're sort of free to create something.
So the how, you know, I understand you really have deep insight into Japanese culture, according to our conversation before. So what would you like to communicate to New Yorkers via Bonsai Kakigori?
Yeah, I think first of all, I really appreciate it. That's so kind for you to say. It would be, naive of me to say that, you know, I've taken two trips to Japan and I've got to experience such great moments in that country full of like rich culture. But I, you know, I still think I am nowhere near like having a deep insight of Japanese culture. Like, I'm somewhere in the periphery, and it's such a rich and deep culture, that I would be lucky in my lifetime to sort of really try to like crack the nut and experience it fully. But thank you.
Yeah, but some people can spend years and years in certain country, but you never crack that.
Yeah.
Right?
So, and I don't think I ever will. I can just experience the peripheries and enjoy it. I think, to answer your question, what I would like people to get from Banzai is just exactly what I felt at the Kizutens in Japan, is this sort of extremely welcoming and uplifting environment.
Mm.
Every time I left one of those Kizutens, I felt a lot better and my day was improved.
Mm.
Like the word that I sort of came away from those experiences having is being uplifted.
Mm.
Like I just felt better, more energetic, happier.
Right.
And that is what I want to communicate to people about Banzai. Mm. So that when they go in, hopefully they leave away feeling a little bit more uplifted.
Right. That reminds me of the word Ichigo Ichie. It's a kind of like tea ceremony term. So there's no more opportunity like this exact same situation. You can came here in this setting. It never happens again. So I'll do best to make you happy, give you the best I can offer. So that sounds like what are you trying to do?
That's beautiful.
Yeah, Ichigo Ichie, right? Yeah, so who are your customers and what their favorite items?
Oh boy. Yeah, we have, you know, it's New York, so every single type of person that you can imagine.
Mm.
I think there tends to be a leniency to like more of an Asian population that is more aware about this dessert. So like there's more of a prevalence of shaved ice in Asian countries, so like bingzu and Taiwanese shaved ice, and of course kakigori. So I think the largest demographic that comes to Banzai is Asians, because they're more aware of this type of dessert.
Mm.
But we'd also get, you know, ton of tourists, ton of New Yorkers who want to experience it, and it really varies. The most popular item though is the strawberries and cream. And I think the reason is twofold. I think one, it's delicious. Actually, maybe three. One, it's delicious. Two, it's just sounds extremely refreshing and yummy.
Mm-hmm.
Like you want to order that flavor. And three, people are coming to Banzai for the first time experiencing kakigori. So they're already like at a discomfort, not in their comfort zone. And so they look at the menu and they say, you know, they see strawberries and cream. And they say, okay, I can latch onto that idea. Like,
right.
I feel comfortable ordering something that is strawberries and cream because I know I've had that before.
Right.
It's one of my favorites, too. It's also really, really yummy.
Right. Yeah. It's like a pizza margarita, right? Same thing. Like, it's a good test. And also, you feel comfortable. It's such a comfort food anyways.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah. And then one thing that you told me earlier is that kakigori is very simple. But that's why it's such a representative dish to feature seasonal flavors of ingredients, which is the key word for Japanese cuisine. And I think that it's like a simple thing can show, it can be a medium to show omotenashi. So you really got it. I'm so glad. I learned a lot from you.
Thank you.
What's the appeal of your kakigori to New Yorkers? Because yours look very beautiful, right? Kind of like I think Theo made it almost like a cake or something, very elaborate look. So is that something you try to make it visually appealing to New Yorkers?
I don't think so. I think the kakigori itself just naturally happens to be very visually appealing. We tried to make it, like I mentioned, as delicious as possible. If one of the flavors happens to be more visually appealing than the other, that's great. As a very talented chef, you know, a component of serving really delicious food is also that it's presentable and that looks appealing. So I'm sure Theo, when he plates things, is also thinking about how to make it look beautiful.
Right.
But it's not necessarily like a driving force on how to build the kakigori. Says, you know, how do we make it look the most visually appealing possible?
Right. Okay. You have a few store locations. So where are they?
So we have three locations where you can get kakigori. So you can get it at Canal Street Market in Chinatown, at our store in the Lower East Side on Stanton Street between Ludlow and Orchard, and at Smorgasburg on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays.
Okay. I'm sure the Smorgasburg is really selling now.
Yeah, it's busy there.
Yeah. Happened to go there like last weekend. And it's mostly they're really hot food selling. But yeah, I wanted a kakigori. I didn't see yours though at that time.
Really?
Yeah, maybe I missed it. I was with a bunch of other people. So anyway, so what is your plan?
My plan? As it pertains to bonsai, I think my plan is to make sure that we are creating the best possible experience for people. I think we're still quite away from being at the point where we want to be. And if we can feel like we are, like I mentioned, creating those moments of uplift for people consistently all the time, and we're doing well, then we can think about, then, you know, in the future, we can think about a second point.
Right.
But Shake Shack didn't open their second location until 5 years, until they had, you know, huge lines and they were able to consistently put out an experience that was great. So until we can figure out how to make people feel great every single time, and feel like we can do it, you know, well with two locations, then we can think about the second one.
Right. Well, I'm so glad you're doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
Yeah. So where can we find your updates online?
So you can find us at Bonsai Kakigori on Instagram. So that's just at Bonsai Kakigori, and also our website, bonsaikakigori.com.
Awesome. All right, so good luck.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for coming today. So, and please keep us posted.
I will, absolutely.
Yep. So, listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or kikotaema.com. Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. My engineer is Matt Patterson, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.